everybody. Connor Listoka here. This is 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back, the podcast where we read books that we are not expecting to like. We, the royal we, of course, being me and Mike Nelson, who is joining me from his own remote location in the most remote of the Minnesota-named states. Mike, how are you?
I'm good. It is very, very remote for all of us right now, but I'm happy to have a lot of chapters with me. It's good to have to. If you're going to have a book, you might as well have as many chapters as you possibly can.
It really does seem like a sitcom where someone has taken a creative writing class and the fictional hack teacher has sort of sat them down and just like pointed at the chalkboard where he's just written the word chapters. Chapters are the key, everybody. Like, take that note down. Thank me when you hit the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, I don't know what this, to what end is this, it's the footnotes of David Foster Wallace. Like, all right, this is starting to frustrate. You've chosen this as the centerpiece. This is your métier and you're running with it. But to what end? To what end?
Well, I mean, I think there's an answer to that for this guy. Like, but first of all, how many chapters do you think there are in total in this book? Just guess your over under. So we read through 60 today.
207?
No, just 128.
Okay.
But yeah, so we really hit the peak in this section, I feel like, of whatever his shtick is here. And it really is just soap opera, Batman serial type of thing where you end on some false tension. And obviously, if you kept telling the story in a normal fashion, even a long Shadow Moon type chapter, there is no tension, but the fact that you end the chapter and then go across the world to Spain or something, you can pretend that there is for another five pages before you get right back and immediately diffuse the tension. It's like,
you know, yes, slightly uncomfortable office situation. Cut.
Yes.
Oh no. What's going to happen at the slightly uncomfortable office situation? We'll find out in a minute, I guess.
And then what happens is it was fine. It's, you know, it's Batman gets into the car explodes. You know, how will Batman survive this? You know, find out next week. And then you find out that he got out of the car. And that's like, well, that's, right. It's not what you showed us. It's not what you told us.
Right. The woman from Misery had a point. Wasn't that her big complaint?
What was the complaint?
Well, it was that he wrote a fake ending when she forces him to write a book, and he does the fake Batman thing, and that's when she really freaks out and screams at him, is like, you know, he got out of the car, you know, he didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car.
Wow. Yep. Well, she would have a big problem with this. Dan Brown.
She would not enjoy this.
Tied up and knocking the Penguin off the shelf. But yeah, so like that said, we do have, I believe, 24 chapters to cover here, and many of them are a page and a half, which in this book is, you know, 120 words or so. So probably should dive into that.
Yeah, we should. We have all of our departments,
of course. Yeah. We're going to try to get to some emails today, and got some fanfic that really threw you for a loop last time. We'll see if that holds up, and we've got dumb sentences, plenty of those.
You going to do another stunt fanfic on me?
What? Everything I do is within the rules of here. And people wrote in. I think last time we promised that you were going to read it to me, but I think we forgot about that. So we'll have to do that next time.
We will. Okay.
But yeah, we started chapter 37, which is, you know, a lot of these chapters, like we said, don't have a lot going for them. This one has some nice Dan Brown-isms for us right away, because he's at the Alfonso 13th Hotel, David Becker is. And he wanders tiredly over to the bar where a dwarf-like bartender lay a napkin in front of him. And so what does dwarf-like mean to you?
I mean, singing songs about mining and pulling on each other's beards and stuff? I don't know.
What does dwarf-like mean that you could just not have dwarf mean?
I don't. I guess that's the question. Yeah, I don't know.
But our hero here is sort of asking him about where he could find the punks that he's looking for, who, as far as he knows, have the code ring. And he says, "I don't know, Señor. I don't know, but certainly not here. How about a drink?" And then our hero Becker felt like shaking the guy. Nothing was going quite the way he planned. So he gets politely offered a drink by this presumably tiny guy and just feels like grabbing him by the collar and shaking him back and forth, which I don't think he'd probably do if he was a normal sized guy.
But then we get this, and I assume he went to Fax King for this.
Yes, yes.
The bartender looked baffled after he ordered his cranberry juice. Solo? Cranberry juice was a popular drink in Spain, but drinking it alone was unheard of. My note is simply, this cannot be true. <It's> cannot.
Impossible. It is Albanian cars don't have seatbelts.
I mean, what do you make of this? Did he have a friend who was so annoyed by him asking questions about Spain because his friend had gone there a couple times or had a business that he consulted with there? And so his friend said, oh, okay, what else do you want? Oh, here's one. Cranberry juice is very popular, but nobody ever drinks it alone. Really? Yeah. He's obviously putting him on.
Yeah, it's the fake road names or town names on maps from the old days, so map makers could tell if people plagiarized their work. It's just his friend putting in fake facts and seeing if he's actually doing his research.
Right.
Man, yeah, that was my favorite. But then he keeps going with it. The bartender is dwarf-like, but he's also very persistent with not serving virgin drinks to people. The bartender pressed a splash of vodka. No, gracias. Gratis, he coaxed, on the house. And then...
Yeah, the bartender's so insulted that he'd drink cranberry juice alone,
yeah,
that the way to soften the blow is to add some vodka for free?
It's, yeah.
That's what this chapter is about, right?
That's all it is about, yes. And it's... He's got, like, you know, the government has made a mortal enemy of ocean spray or something, and they've pledged never to serve it, and so the bartender feels the government peering down his neck here.
It's so strange.
Through the pounding in his head, Becker pictured the filthy streets of Triana, the stifling heat, and the long night ahead of him. What the hell, he nodded. Si, echame un poco de vodka. The bartender seemed much relieved and hustled off to make the drink. And they, so yeah, my note was, what in the name of hell is going on? And, you know, a logical thing you could think is that this bartender's trying to spike his drink or something. They're trying to get him drunk and take advantage of him or something. But, you know, we quickly learned that that is a red herring. You know, there's no, it doesn't happen. We can clear up that confusion right away.
Well, also, it's just all it is solving the problem of drinking his cranberry juice alone. So, yeah, that's why I didn't think there was any subterfuge, because we already have that oddity. And then so the way to solve it is to add vodka. It's like, okay, I don't think this is a plot. This is just his own bizarre obsession with something he heard once, which is obviously not true.
It's, so I guess if he wanted to spike the drink, he could have just spiked the cranberry juice, so...
Yes, as, you know, David turned away, the dwarf, like, crept up to his drink and added something from a dropper, you know.
Or they could...
Then we cut to an office somewhere.
Right. They could keep the cranberry juice pre-spiked, I guess, because if you order it, you're clearly just a foreigner who's up to no good. So you may as well just, since no Spaniards are opening or
Señor, in Spain, the cranberry juice and vodka are never put together until the last second, sir. Didn't you know this?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, throw it on the pile of absurd things that we've learned about other countries that cannot possibly be true.
Right. Chapter 38.
Yeah. So this is what we were talking about earlier. We had left off our last section with Hale's monitor being left on as she had rooted around on his computer.
Right. So that was the tension. So
yeah.
Here we are.
Immediately diffused. It's
yes, of course.
He comes in and she's, you know, she's backed up against the kitchen, hoping he's not going to eat tofu at her. And then she glances at his monitor, which is on. And, you know, how is she going to get out of here? Someone bangs on the glass and Hale goes to look at him.
Yep, done. Tension averted.
She walks over, turns off the monitor, and there we go.
And it's Chartreukian.
Mm-hmm.
And he was banging his sweaty fists against the glass again. I assume there also his meaty face was there.
Yep.
If his sweaty, disgusting, grimy fists were banging against the glass. He looked like he'd seen Armageddon. Now, I just have to ask, do you think the old chart has a robust understanding of Armageddon? Like, how, what, really?
Yeah. Like, whose culture is he? Is it like Ragnarok, or is it, every religion probably has their own interpretation of how it works.
But he seems to be in that state pretty much all the time, too.
Yeah.
So you'd think you'd be used to it. He's always in a panic and sort of screaming and worried about this and that. So anyway, I just thought that, Armageddon.
Right, yeah. He's ratcheted it up to, he's pulled his hair out. Maybe that's the signifier here. But like, yeah, your points about the sweatiness, I think that this would be another teacher with the blackboard, pointing to, men, sweaty, thick-fleshed, disgusting pigs. Women, every single one of them is a sex goddess. Like, that's how you write a book.
Yep.
Because that plays out
faintly of baby powder, and there's a peak of their bra and panties everywhere.
Yeah, even if they're 65 or whatever, it's like... Right. Because, that plays out, again, with more characters we learn about in this book as well.
Well, I don't have anything else for 38. That's
no.
it.
It's no. Yeah, exactly. It was a page and a half. But 39 moves immediately into what I was talking about with the...
My. 39. Revolting.
Yeah. So I'm gonna read you this, and you tell me, it's a comparison that we've made many times, but you tell me what the intended audience is meant to be doing at this. Rocio Eva Granada stood naked in front of the bathroom mirror. We get really mystery here. This was the moment she'd been dreading all day. The German was on the bed waiting for her. He was the biggest man she'd ever been with. Reluctantly, she took an ice cube from the water bucket and rubbed it across her nipples. They quickly hardened. This was her gift to make men feel wanted. It's what kept them coming back. She ran her hands across her supple, well-tanned body and hoped it would survive another 4 or 5 more years until she had enough to retire. So you've got people, banging on their heads with shoes. And, their hearts are leaping out of their chests reading this. And then
you get
her stepping into the room. As Rocio stepped into the room, the German's eyes bulged. So he has an actual honest to God cartoon wolf reaction as she enters the room.
Yeah. I also love I've referred to this before that he's. So she's rubbing an ice cube across her nipples.
Yes.
And then running, and then her looking at her well-tanned body. And at the same time, she's hoping that it would last another 4 or 5 years till she could retire.
Okay.
Is that how people, honestly? Gee, I hope I last another 4 or 5. Boy, that's cold. It's just, they're in strange states that seem sort of, polar ends.
Right, yeah.
It's just, I just got to get this ice on my nipples is what she's thinking. She's not, there's not a lot else going on.
Yeah, she's deciding between like tassels, clamps. Oh man, like, S&P really tanked today. So that's going to set me back another year. I really should have moved over. Maybe I'll use the electro clamps tonight. Yeah, I probably should have moved some over into bonds, as that's what we should have done at this point of the planning phase. But oh boy, no, I'll go with a blindfold.
All right, let's climb on top of this enormous German.
Not enormous everywhere, though. She chuckled in relief because the organ between his legs was tiny.
God.
They really set him up for some real moments of dignity in this, his final hours, minutes here on Earth.
Oh, yes. just another minute. Yeah, this is just gross.
Yeah.
I don't have many notes because it just... obviously he's dying, so.
Right, well, not before his fat fingers groped at every inch of her body and she gasped and choked against his putty-like neck. Putty-like is never one of those words that you hope gets applied to someone on their wedding day or something like that. You never think the putty-like bride walked down the aisle and there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Darling, you look absolutely putty-like. Why, thank you.
Yes, your fingers are notably fat today, my dear.
Oh, and sweaty, I see.
But then you get another one of these things. So he's sort of like gasping. You know, he's choking or something. We get the feeling maybe his drink was spiked, but he's on top of her, crushing her. And like you said before, is this really what would be going through her mind? Random thoughts cascaded through her mind, faces of the countless men she'd satisfied, ceilings she'd stared at for hours in the dark, her dreams of having children. So that you'd think that might not be something going through her mind at this point in time.
She was doing that, mind you, as she felt her ribs cracking. So she felt them.
Yeah.
Because they were in fact cracking.
And yeah, so it's a very peculiar way that this one ends. There's a bullet hole in his temple that's gushing blood all over her. She tried to scream, but there was no air left in her lungs. He was crushing her. She's clawing at him. You get the point that this 300-pound man is just on top of her and suffocating her, which would be a gross way to go. But then she sees a hand, a gun with a silencer, a flash of light, and then nothing. So it seemed like she then gets shot too, like he was shot by the wire rim glasses man, but he feels like it wasn't enough just for her to be crushed. He has to shoot her too.
Yeah, I found that odd. Like, why she didn't even know what was happening. She'd never get out of there.
Yes.
So, like, now you're going to shoot me? Like, what?
Right.
Maybe it was mercy. Maybe he's a decent guy. You know, he's got a little silver lining to his evilness.
Yeah, I suppose it could be mercy or just no stone left unturned. But the important thing was that tiny organ.
That's true. And the fact that he was the most enormous man she'd ever seen.
Yes.
And like, she went to like a lot of circuses, like European circuses too. So he was bigger than circus fat.
Yes. Yeah. She's like, you know, I have a poster of those Guinness World Records tiny bike twins as well. And this, you know, I'm counting that in my assessment here.
Both of those guys can fit inside you without even repositioning them.
Well, unfortunately, that's the end of the second hottest person in the book and the probably, you know, third grossest guy. So,
right. I mean, how do you even rate those at this point?
I don't
know. Just assume every guy is a misshapen dwarf or a troll or a fat pig with sweat dripping off of him.
We move on to chapter 40.
Indeed.
Yeah, we get some good drama here. This is back at the back in crypto.
Right, and this is the Chartreukian who has just seen the Armageddon. Mm-hmm. He comes in hot with a lot of exclamation points. There's exclamation points after all of this. Miss Fletcher, we have a virus. I'm positive. You have to. And so all of them,
wow.
Exclamation points.
Yeah, and there's more. He says, you know, Commander Strathmore told you to go home, exclamation point. Fuck Strathmore, he screamed, the words resounding through the dome. And so just remember, like, there was a book that I kept suggesting that was called Antigua, I think. And, like, the only thing we knew about it was that it was a self-published novel by a couple who put exclamation marks at the end of every sentence. And, like, right. That was enough for us to consider, like, this sounds really bad. Here it is.
But such a great moment. The all caps, fuck Strathmore. And then he's right behind me, isn't he? Mr. Chartreukian.
But we...
Yes, sir.
But we get one of your favorite things, where it's just it's a insanely long amount of time if we're taking it at its face value. It says Strathmore's like up on his, you know, balcony or catwalk or whatever. Strathmore was fixated on the young SysSec. He descended the stairs without so much as a blink, keeping his eyes trained on Chartreukian the whole way down. He made his way across the crypto floor and stopped 6 inches in front of the trembling technician. What did you say? So it's yet again the walk down the hall in Ready Player One or whatever. Just he just looks at him the whole way he's walking down the thing before he responds.
Yeah, it's like there's a moment in the original producers that always made me laugh when he's hiding outside of his office when they first meet, and then he steps out of his office, sees him, and they do a super long Bugs Bunny take of him coming back out the door, very, very slowly walking up until they're nose to nose and then screaming in his face. And it's so long that it's funny, yeah, obviously. And right, that's what this is. This is almost identical.
Yeah, it would obviously take at least a minute for him to walk over there without addressing what he had just said. But in the book, it's two sentences, so it doesn't seem super absurd.
Yeah, is Hale during that time has wolfed down an entire loaf of tofu.
Silken tofu, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the olive oil he's needed to open up a new bottle.
He's glugged it down.
And then we get this, which I, you know, it, once you learn to recognize it, it bugs the hell out of me. A whole bunch of inner things where Susan knows that Hale is Endicoter, or at least in the context of what we've been told, that's what she thinks. Commander, Susan interjected, if I could just... Strathmore waved her off. His eyes never left the SysSec. And then very soon after that, we get her saying again, like, Commander, I must again. Strathmore silenced her with an angry wave. And so it's very frustrating. And it's obviously a cheap way to instill drama. But I was just like, if this was the real situation we've been told it is, national security, what would a real person do? You know, so it's a it's 9/11 at 6:30 in the morning, and you've gotten the notification that some guys are about to board a plane they intend to hijack, and you're trying to give that news to me.
Right. Well, I would obviously try to catch your eye, and then he puts it. So Susan tried desperately to catch Strathmore. That's basically the whole chapter from now on. Commander, Hale is North Dakota, and. What I thought of here was there was a time where we went to Nashville. I can't remember if I've ever told the story on the podcast. If I am, I'm in podcast jail.
All right.
But the guy who rented us the home in Nashville, this is trying to communicate something.
I don't think this has been on the podcast.
With eyes. So he's there when we show up, which is unusual when you're renting a house. But he's there fixing something. And he comes in and just starts chatting with us. And this is not extremely welcome. We're starting to work already. And
almost a worse nightmare. Yeah.
The fellow says, because just contact my assistant then, because I'm going off tomorrow. I'm going to go to a Caribbean island for a little vacation. And then total silence. And then that's when my eyes flashing to everyone in the room. Don't you dare ask him which Caribbean island he's. If anyone does, you are fired. I remember just like flashing it in Morse code to everyone. And we all,
to our
credit, of course, 100% froze him out.
Groupthink was strong in that situation.
It was the best. It was the most clunky silence that I've ever. It just laid there.
I think he said, I'm going down there for like 24 hours for some business or something. It was even more leading. It was even more like, please ask me about it than it was a vacation.
Leaning on the half wall. And then he had to sort of awkwardly, figure out what to do with his hands as he made his exit. All right, then. I'll just be. Down there.
He adjusts a picture on the wall or something. Huh, look at that. All right.
Yes, exactly. Puts a piece of blue tape on. I'll take care of that later. All right. I'm going to get going then, guys. Anyway, that's my story of catching someone's eyes and trying to flash. Hale is North Dakota.
Yeah. So it was easy enough in that situation, which, you know, was not going to involve, you know, death or national security. And yet she's somehow unable to just like jump in and, you know, say whatever she needs to.
Sir, I must immediately talk to you in private.
Yeah.
Probably comes up 20 times a day where that has to happen because you're in crypto.
So, yeah. right. As his, you know, and they have a good relationship. He trusts her, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Let
me take you into this secure room that we obviously, you know, and I'll chat for a minute, and I'll tell you the most important thing that is happening right now.
Yeah, I've made the comparison before, but like that's the only way they were able to sustain any sort of tension on Lost was like, you know, just tell me where we are. I can't do that now. And it's like, you know, you're just offering some mush-mouthed explanation that no person that was ever, you know, as frustrated as the people on that island would ever accept.
Right. But when Strathmore starts to get this news, here's interesting. Strathmore's complexion turned a deep red, Okay, so is oxygen deprivation or the opposite? I don't know how that works. Strathmore's face, a couple sentences later, turned an even deeper shade of crimson.
Oh my God,
sir! Get up on this table.
Yeah,
I will start hammering on your chest.
Yeah, loosen your tie. Like you know, sit down and have a cold drink.
An even deeper shade of crimson. I mean, take it at face value. Have you ever seen a human?
An umpire. I mean, a manager chewing out an umpire, maybe like Don Zimmer. Like, I don't know. Yeah. But like, he's also vacillating between two wildly different mixed metaphors here, because it says when Strathmore spoke, his voice was like ice. Mr. Chartrukian, not that it is any concern of yours, but I passed past Gauntlet. So his voice is like ice. He went on, his temper hovering near the boiling point.
Oh, God. I missed that.
Make up your mind. It's either, actual below zero, or it is 100 degrees or whatever it is, 212.
Oh, my God. That is awful.
And then it has some inner workings of genius, or I mean, I'm sorry, of Gauntlet and then Translator. It's just like he bypassed it. It's some tech stuff that isn't super important, but... he orders Chartrukian to leave and says, this discussion is over, which I found amusing because he's like, Hale, who also isn't supposed to be there, is, you know, he's like, you know, Hale, you haven't murdered anyone in a couple months. You can stick around.
Right. And then Hale, typical Hale, man, he opens the door graciously towards the Node 3 and says, after you, Sue. Oh, Hale, you. Oh. What's his car again?
A Megabyte was his hard drive. I forget which. Oh, he drives a Lotus, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Megabyte was the license plate.
Right. Oh, Hale. Oh, that's all I got for
you. Yeah, I think so, too. Chapter 41, we get another slight chapter, but it gets a detail about the assassin, the wire-rimmed glasses man. He takes the name out of everyone he jots down, which seems, you know, sort of a destined to fail type of thing in terms of the evidence amount you when you get caught for all your murders. But we do get this other detail, which is a sort of a Dan Brownian thing. The man with the wire rim glasses was replacing a hotel master key. He had not sensed her scream when he struck her, but he had no way of knowing for sure. He had been deaf since he was 12. And I think you know about, you've seen the Da Vinci Code movie. You get that in the assassin, and that one is a monk who is also an albino. So Dan, yes. Brown likes giving his assassins these sort of weird characteristics to make them more interesting, I guess.
Is that interesting, though? I don't know.
Preposterous is what I would think for this trained assassin to be.
Albino, if he'd made him Albanian.
Yeah, he's not allowing his women outside during the day. He's, what else did they do? Not put sugar in their coffee.
He's clipping off the seatbelts of every Lotus he comes across. But the three stories below, David Becker paid his tab and wandered across the lobby, his half-finished drink in hand. I thought he hated it.
Right, yes.
Didn't he nearly spit it out?
Yeah.
You having to take this with me, dwarf? I mean, bartender. But sir... In Spain, we never take our half-finished drink into the lobby. It's just a thing we don't do.
Don't make me grab and shake you.
But that's all I have for that. That was just to give us the touch of the David and the assassin are near each other now.
Yeah, but
so close.
I didn't understand this part. Maybe I'm missing something. As he passed the elevator door, the door slid open, and there was a man inside. All Becker saw were thick wire rim glasses. I don't understand how can wire rim glasses be thick? I guess the lenses. Anyway, the man raised a handkerchief to blow his nose. Becker smiled politely and moved on into the stifling civilian night. What is going, like, did the assassin see him? I mean, he smiled politely, which usually, you know, implies eye contact. But the handkerchief, does that mean he didn't see him because of a stupid, you know?
I don't know what's happening there. Is he being stopped by the man enter? No, the elevator doors open. The guy doesn't move. So he stares in, and all he sees are his glasses. And then he blows his nose, so Becker smiles.
when you put it that way.
It's an odd moment, but it's just meant to be like, you know, Becker paused and sensed the danger or whatever, but he just doesn't know how to write it.
But the assassin saw him, it seems.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
and the assassin knows who he is because he's been following him.
He's looking for him, yeah. So.
But you don't even get like a parade starts up in front of him, you know, and the assassin can't, you know, get across the street to kill him. I don't know.
Okay. I guess that in a mere two paragraphs, we'll be finding out more about it.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. Two paragraphs and eight chapters.
Right.
Chapter 42, we go back to SysSec. And Susan is pacing frantically. She wished she'd exposed Hale when she had the chance. And yeah, it does seem like she really blew her chance there when she was standing next to her boss, who could have helped her out here.
Very, very weird chapter. Let me see. I wrote something down here. I'm trying to figure out why. If you've got something,
sure.
Do it.
Well, I mean, she's still pacing around, and Hale's, I guess, playing solitaire on his computer or something. But she gazes up at Strathmore's workstation and knew she couldn't wait any longer. It was time to interrupt the commander's phone call. She stood and headed for the door. So she just has decided to kill some time by virtue of it just being a book, because in real life, no one would behave this way. And then Hale demands to know what's going on. There's something going on here today. What is it? Let me out, Susan said as evenly as possible, feeling a sudden twinge of danger. Sudden? We're too, you know, she's been feeling danger for 180 pages at this point in time. And then it says that she would have to make a detour before visiting the commander. Greg Hale could suspect nothing. And then I just noted that 70 words before that in the book, she had looked at Hale and thought to herself, you know damn well what's going on.
So right.
Is he suspecting something? Yes. But he can suspect nothing. And I'm suddenly feeling danger when I've been alarmed and like on the edge of my seat for the past, you know, 50 chapters of this book.
My eyes have been bugging out of my head. But this is a great moment where this doesn't he seem like a guy who should just be always called Hale? But she says, back off, Greg. That seems so. It softens the moment.
It does, yeah.
Like, come on, Hale. You know damn well. You know, instead, back off, Greg.
Gregory, please.
Yes. But what a ruse and what a way to end her chapter, having to fake going to the bathroom.
Yes, she circled towards it and making a detour. Yeah, I don't know. You would also feel that like maybe just sitting at her desk, she might be able to send him an email too, like without arousing any suspicion.
Right.
I mean, we are in this newfangled world of email, so maybe it hasn't occurred to her yet because it is only 1997.
It is the kind of tension of you know, The Office with Michael Scott doing some shenanigans and he doesn't want the boss to see or something. Like that's about that level of tension.
Yeah, peeking behind a potted plant or something.
Right. That's all I got.
Yeah.
And,
Chapter
43.
Chapter 43 finally gets some real meat to it. We get to introduce to not one, but two new characters. Chad Brinkerhoff, who's the personal aide to the NSA director who we've not met yet. And finally, Midge Milken.
Oh, I'm so glad we're finally to Midge.
Yeah, she pays off big time. She defied my expectations. But
I'm trying to think, what is her, what do you think he's getting at here? Who's he trying to portray? It's a total cliche. I think it comes from, you know, I think I said last time, like a Hitchcock movie, you know.
Yep.
There's the femme fatale, and then there's the, you know, like Rear Window or something, where there's the sort of frumpy woman who loves Jimmy Stewart and he doesn't pay her any mind or whatever. Like, come on, Midge, you know.
Yes. But yeah, so what I conjured up was sort of there's a great Gary Gulman stand-up bit. Do you know him?
Yeah, vaguely.
He did a bit about the people who invented the state postal codes.
Oh yeah,
it's a very long. You know, it's very funny, but it's absurd. But in that bit, he plays a character who's this brassy secretary who he always does this move of like he puts his hand back and sort of like pushes her hair up, like you know, to yes. do her do like that. And that is pretty much what we're doing here. That that sort of Mad Men stereotype. If Joan was, you know, 15 or 20 years older, I think, who was, you know, still yes. flirty, but you know, old enough to be you're old enough to be my mother.
Yep. Well, in fact, we get this. A consummate flirt and an ex-wife three times over, Midge prowled the six-room directorial suite with a saucy authority.
Yes.
Snap of the gum is implied, of course.
Uh-huh. That was great. And a Danish listener wrote in, a Danish listener named Lysi said that in her translation, it says Midge is moving with a juicy authority.
Wow.
And I sort of, we went back and forth and I said, that's insane. And they said, unfortunately, I can't find a good translation of saftpant or something. But imagine an orange very, very full of juice. It's quite hard when you press it. So they imagine he's talking about ahem boobies. But it's fun for people to send these in when it's, you know, the poor translator who's like, this dog shit, how do I bring this into our dignified language here?
Oh, Midge milking.
But so she's flirting with Chad Brinkerhoff, who is another sort of character where he can't make up his mind what we're supposed to think of this person, because he's the personal aide to the NSA director, but also gets described as powerless, and he's like filled with ennui, you know, sort of the way that I was in my first job out of college working at a glasses lens company, where you're sort of like rudderless and despondent about this lot in life, even though he's been clearly working at this for a decade plus to sort of carve out this niche in the highest echelons of power.
Yeah, and the physical description, a jaunty 45.
Yeah, I like that.
Well-pressed, well-groomed, and well-informed.
Yeah.
So setting us up for a very competent, you know, 80s Alec Baldwin character or something.
Yeah, definitely. You know? It says it describes him as being handsome enough to give his press conferences. So yeah, a Wolf of Wall Street type.
Yeah, his eyes were a brilliant blue.
Right.
And then as it goes on, he's sort of a wet fish of a guy. I don't understand this.
Yeah, he describes his own existence as, where is it? Do I have it? But it says there were definite benefits to being the director's personal aide. He had a plush office, full access to all the NSA departments, and a certain level of distinction that came from the company he kept. But then it describes his own existence as pathetic, I think. So, you know,
yeah.
Make up your damn mind. It doesn't need to be both. Like,
right. And you know, he could obviously kill it. He's super handsome and he's, you know, very well placed in his career and all of this. And then Brinkerhoff looks at Midge Milken. She was 60, slightly heavy, and much to the puzzlement of Brinkerhoff, quite appealing. So why is he puzzled at it?
I don't know. It boggles the mind why he's puzzled, why he finds someone attractive. You don't need to, right. You know.
Right. I'm mystified. You know, again, looking at Joan from right. Mad Men, I don't get it.
And he thinks, damn, eyeing her gray cashmere dress, either I'm getting older or she's looking younger. So once again, just any woman, you know, by virtue of being a woman is, you know, entrancing the men in this novel.
Slightly heavy. What do you think he's getting at there?
It's again, I don't know how to draw you a description of this, because it just pretty much started thinking of Joan from the first page. But I don't know. Three times married and juicy.
Should we get Bob Fingerman on this?
Yeah, probably. Draw Midge Milken.
I'll draw this Midge Milken.
Yeah, this is pretty much one of the characters. You've thrown in these meaningless terms and ex-wife three times over. It's like, you know, if she was putting together her own pontoon boat, we'd have one of our characters.
Yeah. And so then this handsome guy with blue, piercing blue eyes and sandy hair says, Midge, I have no life. What do you mean? this is our puzzlement. Now it's our turn to be puzzled.
Right.
Who is this guy?
Right. But yeah, but we get wind that he does. I mean, he's also doing just fine. He's, you know, banging this 27-year-old Carmen Huerta in the break room or something. And Midge is observing that via the Big Brother system,
which he was unaware of.
Right. Yeah. He's works at the NSA, and yet he thinks that there are places where he can go and have sex with people during work hours.
Yes. Then when he hears news that that's probably not the best thing to do because people could see you, he's like, what? Huh? You're at the NSA.
Their banter, you can probably describe better what, like, sort of movie or play this is supposed to be ripped off from. But I just thought, you know, the back and forth of a 40s movie, you know, I don't know, like if like Desk Set, Cary Grant has this type of thing. But he eyed her pleadingly and rolled his aching neck. My shoulders are tight. Midge didn't bite. We'll take an aspirin. He pouted. No back rub? She shook her head. Cosmopolitan says 2/3 of back rubs end in sex. Brinkerhoff looked indignant. Ours never do. Precisely, she winked. That's the problem.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Actually, it reminds me of Double Indemnity.
Okay.
You know that? It's the famous noir movie. He's an insurance salesman, and she's the femme fatale. And, you know, their opening dialogue is like, he's like, why don't you come down here, and we'll talk about that over this drink. And she's like, whoa, slow down. This is a no-speeding zone. How fast was I going, officer?
Oh, God, yeah. Yep, that's what he's going for here.
And it's just, you know, back and forth, rapid fire. It's a great movie, but...
right, yeah, done well.
That was the model of it.
Yeah. So. But yeah, so like, you know, everyone continues to be super horny as well. He's just picturing, you know, Carmen's lissome body, dark thighs, AM radio playing hot San Juan salsa. Maybe I'll drop by for a snack when I'm done. And then he's plowing through documents and checking figures. Images of Carmen Huerta smearing herself with honey and confectioner sugar began playing in his head. I don't know. It would be an awful situation if she, like, you know, was sort of making eye contact with him while reaching for the honey, but she instead, like, grabbed the Vichy Soie and started smearing that everywhere. Like.
Right. Still sexy to me. I'm a big fan of cold potato soup.
And yeah, he's sort of where this chapter has its drama, other than the gum snapping, is he's looking at the figures about how long. What's the thing? The translator takes to run the codes. And this is something I thought was, you know, annoyed me. As long as the figure was $1,000 in cost below code, Fontaine didn't switch. A grand a pop, Brinkerhoff chuckled. Our tax dollars at work. And I was just like, well, you can't just say our tax dollars at work with no context whatsoever. Like, a grand a pop to translate a code, does that... A lot, not much. It's someone saying, like, in this economy,
right?
You know, or what are we, millionaires? It just, you know, it's just that the laziest thing to convey that he assumes it's being wasted. But I don't know. NSA has a budget, and we assume that there's some good to be done from it. So I guess it is our tax dollars at work.
Right. So, but he's checking the columns while he's thinking of, you know, the Carmen situation when the sugars and all of that and honey. And then he comes across a figure. $1 billion? The images of Carmen vanished. So right up through that.
Right.
You see, you know, right up through the $1 billion. But then they disappeared after that.
Was it like in a movie where a character is imagining a get-quick-quick scheme, and then when they when the bubble is burst, they're sort of wings and it flies away like the bag of
riches? Right. So that's the end of the chapter, as he sees that figure and then screams out to Midge, come back.
Midge! Yeah. Yeah, and that takes us into chapter 44, where we probably got to pick up the pace here.
We have to pick up the pace, yeah.
This is just a description of how the government, in all their foresight, relocated the NSA's main database to one singular ultra-secure fort, where there's like no backups or anything, and they saw no problems with this.
Yes. So my only note for that is, here's a sentence. By the early 90s, the government's once secure internet, in quotes, was a congested wasteland of public email and cyber porn. What a stupid prediction.
Yeah, I had that flagged as a dumb sentence.
Oh, sorry.
It's fine. It was just like, you know, I think there was also some good things happening on the internet at that point in time.
Right. Yes. All right. So, yeah, that one's the only note that I had. So should we move along to chapter 45? We have 15 more chapters.
That chapter ends with the introduction of Jabba, but we get the good description of him coming up when we actually meet him. Chapter 45, Becker leaves the hotel and sees a dyed-haired punk, which is who he's looking for. And we get this sort of great self-awareness on the author's part. 30 yards behind them, Becker stared in utter incredulity. His vision was suddenly focused, but he knew what he was seeing was impossible. It was a one-in-a-million chance. All right, like you're making all this up. Like, you don't have to remind us how improbable it is. It's all happening, and we got right. Earlier we got the Susan thinking by some ironic stroke of fate, Tancado's partner was right there under their noses. No, it's all just happening, and it's all pretty hacky. So like, just quit calling our attention to it.
Yeah, don't hang a lantern on this man. Try to move on quickly. So now I'm a little confused. Did he spike his drink? Because he says the vodka was still in him. Nothing about his life seemed in focus at the moment.
Well, I do not believe he spiked his drink, because what he does is he runs to catch the bus. He hops on the bus. It's sort of like, I don't even know what we're supposed to think of here, but he runs full blast, jumps, like catches a door, crawls in, and now David Becker lay collapsed just inside the vehicle's doorway. The pavement raced by only inches away. He was now sober. So I just thought, convenient. That's what... And also, what the hell was the point if he wasn't spiked, or if, you
right.
know?
And this is the guy, he has a half of a vodka cranberry and his whole life is rock? The world's greatest squash champion?
Yeah.
I mean, the Tour de France, they famously used to get bombed at pubs, you know, and then go race for 60 miles up a mountain.
Oh, because
what is this problem here?
I'm not sure. They hand waved that away with saying, like, Susan always thought he was a white lightweight or some garbage, but you would think that a tall athletic guy might have a better tolerance based on just the sheer body mass.
And I hate to pull a erm on this guy. Well, I don't hate to, because I'm going to do it. He's trying to catch the bus because it's in first gear, mm-hmm. right? And he says he had to get it before it downshifted. How in the name of hell do you downshift from first gear? Is he going to cram it into reverse?
And wow.
Drop the tranny out the bottom of the Seville bus?
I suppose, or zero gear. Maybe that's how what Facts King said about Spanish transmissions.
Ah, that's right. Spanish buses famously have a gear below first gear.
And Spanish buses famously, even though the only thing we know about Seville is that people literally melt on the streets from the punishing sun. But it says the rear doors, and as on all Seville buses, it was propped wide open, cheap air conditioning. So the whole city is a death trap of, heat stroke, and yet the buses do not have AC in them. It seems hard to believe, but whatever. It's a minor detail that was just inserted for convenience.
So much about the bus. Really tried to keep this chapter going. I mean, this is over a page, at least in my layout.
Mm-hmm.
And really didn't have to be anything. It was him grabbing the bus, right?
Yeah, it's sort of a Marty McFly late for school situation of trying to chase it down. But he gets on, and not to keep bringing up Alfred Hitchcock, who, apologies to the famed director, but he gets on and he sort of does this like slow pan around, and it's like The Birds, but with teenage punks. Like with the disoriented nausea of a slow motion free fall, Becker gazed at the busload of passengers. They were all punks. At least half of them had red, white, and blue hair. So they're all sort of like looking back at him in silence as he is, as the camera does the pull in but zoom out at the same time.
And then the bus driver does the floors it to knock him down because mm-hmm. he's so annoyed. And Becker, for an instant, David Becker was airborne. Then he landed hard on the gritty floor. And then Wire Room Guy sees the bus pulling away.
So. Yeah, right. Yeah. It's
It's meted out so slowly.
That's the thing. And, you know, it does keep you turning the page, but it's just pure gimmick, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, as we said, you have to turn the page. There's nothing on it.
Chapter 46 is the actual first introduction to Jabba, I guess, as Chartrukian is trying to get in touch with him. Unfortunately, Jabba's line was busy, and we get introduced to just a character who sounds delightful here. Jabba spurned call waiting as an intrusive gimmick that was introduced by AT&T to increase profits by connecting every call. The simple phrase, "I'm on the other line, I'll call you back," made phone companies millions annually. Jabba's refusal of call waiting was his own brand of silent objection to the NSA's requirement he carry an emergency cell at all times. And so that is a great slice of dicks in the 90s, like the same way that I don't know what the thing would be now. I don't have an iPhone because they track me or something like that. But refusing call waiting seems hilariously quaint.
Right. Or, I mean, you know, using alternate systems other than Microsoft back then. Right?
Yes.
Any kind of home rolled system.
Right.
There's no way I'm paying that money to the mothership. No way.
Yeah. So can I install the game on your system? No. Oh, God, no. No, no.
No,
you can't.
No, no, no.
You can't do anything you'd want to do. But, you know, it is a badge of honor.
I'm sticking it to the man, though.
You don't actually meet Jabba. Yeah. They sort of just set the scene of the what lies beneath the actual floor, the sub-levels of the thing. Chartrukian had only been down there once during training. It was like something out of an alien world with its long mazes of catwalks, freon ducts, and a dizzy 136-foot drop to the rumbling power supplies below. So it's trying to just, you know, sort of paint a cinematic picture of what I guess an area we're going to be spending some time in looks like.
Yeah, and as somebody pointed out, the NSA, I mean, like you would imagine, it's probably just a very bland office.
Uh-huh.
But it's like it's like police stations in procedural shows where they're like pumped with blue light and stuff, and they're really dark and everything. We've all seen police stations, or at least off, you know, any kind of government offices.
It's
they
a
all
DMV.
Look like the DMV. Yeah. I mean, so stop trying to make these things art directed that we all know what they are.
Yeah,
I feel like we're being set up for that here.
Right. It's the like the Nostromo in Alien or something.
Right. all right. Well, chapter 47.
This is back to Midge and brother. What's the guy's name?
Brinkerhoff?
Brinkerhoff. Yeah, the pathetic hot 45-year-old.
This guy with the thick sandy hair and the piercing blue eyes and the successful life. Brinkerhoff nodded blankly and tried not to peer down the front of Midge's dress. I mean, he is a loser, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose. But
60-year-old, slightly heavy Midge.
But she's saying, she's not helping the situation. She eyes him askance and says, "This better not be some ploy to get me out of this dress." And at some point in time, they imply that they have gotten busy, right?
But he says ours never does, like two out of three. What was her fact? Cosmopolitan?
Yeah, yeah. Back rubs end in sex or something like that.
Yeah. And he said ours never do.
Oh, yeah. I guess there was something that says, Midge would never tell. She was not without her weaknesses. Midge had indulged in a few indiscretions of her own, mostly wandering back rubs with Brinkerhoff. So that's like, the Patriots owner massage, I guess, type of thing.
Hmm.
A little rub and tug.
Oh, dear.
I mean, that's what that's implying. You know, if it's indiscretions, like a back rub isn't anything to talk about as an indiscretion. Anyway, she explains it away. She says it might be a divide by zero that billion-dollar charge might be. But there's more talk about the NSA and the EFF just sort of setting that stage.
The contempt is dripping here. There were suddenly housewives in Minnesota complaining to America Online and Prodigy that the NSA might be reading their email. Like the NSA gave a damn about a secret recipe for candied yams. Wow. Well, well, well.
Yeah.
It's, that's some That's some elitism there.
Right.
All piled on pretty heavy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's that if you don't have anything to hide sort of attitude, but it's almost a universal agreed upon stance that it wouldn't be a good thing. I did appreciate the shout out to Prodigy, too. That was the first online system we ever had. I still remember my Prodigy password.
Or my Prodigy login,
I guess.
When's the last time you've thought of Prodigy until reading this?
Oh, I think about Prodigy a lot.
Yeah, okay.
I was asking my brother about it recently. I don't remember why, because I remembered if I tried to ask him. He's 7 or 8 years younger, and I was just telling him, yeah, I used to, on Prodigy, I would go to the King's Quest 6 board and answer people's questions before FAQs were a thing. Some guy would be like, I need to figure out how to get past the blind, one of the seven dwarfs. And I'd be like, oh, you need to hold out the rabbit's foot. And like that, and then they would get to the point where they wanted the, there was a copy protection system built into the game where you had to like identify these runes. And I would be like, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And they're like, just tell me what it is. I'm like, well, you should have the, you should have this if you actually bought the game.
Wow.
So yeah, that was my Prodigy experience.
I had a CompuServe.
Okay.
And I canceled it. And then about 18 months later, I was doing the scan of, I thought Bridget was doing it. She thought I was, of looking over our Amex bill.
Mm.
And I saw that CompuServe was still on there. I was infuriated. And I tried, but Amex couldn't pry refund out of them. So for 2 years, I paid for CompuServe.
That is infuriating.
Yes, very much so.
This is a great... you know, we've said that they might be protesting too much about Strathmore being, you know, this, the greatest man she's ever known type of thing. But this is Midge's sort of protesting too much. Deep down, she knew that accusing Strathmore of shirking was absurd. The commander was as dedicated as they came, dedicated to a fault. He bore the evils of the world as his own personal cross. Settle down.
Oh, I have... Whoa, 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 settle down with 2 exclamation points.
But he keeps going. He refuses to settle down. The NSA's skipjack plan had been Strathmore's brainchild, a bold attempt to change the world. Unfortunately, like so many divine quests, this crusade ended in crucifixion.
Jeez.
So a lot of questions. A lot of questions.
Yeah.
One, does she really mean like so many divine quests? Or is she really just thinking about one particular one here?
Right.
If you wanted to grill Dan Brown about how many other divine quests he knows that ended in crucifixion, what do you think he would say?
Right. I was talking about Spartacus.
It reminds me, there was, I don't know where I heard this, but do you remember a guy named Harris Whittles? He was a comedian.
Oh, yeah.
He was on a podcast sometime, and he was just doing a... like little bits he had come up with. And he was like, you know, when people say like, you know, no, like, you know, I've read studies about this. I think most of them are pretty much have read one study. Like no one's going out and reading more than one. I think that's what's happening here with all the divine quests.
But what was that sentence again though? I mean, can you read it? The crusade and quest and,
he bore the evils of his world as his own personal cross. The NSA skipjack plan had been Strathmore's brainchild, a bold attempt to change the world. Unfortunately, like so many divine quests, this crusade ended in crucifixion.
That is just... pry a few of those words out of there, buddy. I mean, come on.
Right, yeah. You had to...
The structure is not sound to hold that many.
You could get rid of crusade and say, this one ended in crucifixion. Like, we've already established it as a divine quest.
Right.
But also, after all that, you know, ignoring the fundamental, you know, over-exaggeration there, it ended in crucifixion. He kept his job. There was no, I mean, there wasn't even like a reprimand or anything. He's still the second in command at the NSA. He has not been crucified. Yeah. He's doing just fine. He still maintained all his power. And like maybe there was a minor public like humiliation in Congress that most of the country wouldn't have cared about.
Right. We get another great Brownism here. There were two things one never questioned about Midge Milken. One of them was her data. He never gets to the other thing.
I marked that and was like, what the hell? He did get to it. It was probably about 300 words later. It was on.
Oh, was it?
It was a page and a half later. Like he let it hang, you know, for no reason whatsoever. The second thing was questioning her hunches. Questioning her hunches was the other thing you never did. Her data and her hunches.
That's like something that a teacher would do to you, you know, like leave something hanging and then, 3 weeks later, what was the thing that I told you about, you know?
Yes, right. So, God damn it.
Such an eye-rolling thing. Yeah. Okay. technically right.
Right. Yeah, and then the detail there is like, you know, she can't snoop in on crypto because crypto's a sealed deal. No video, no sound, no nothing. Strathmore's orders. So yet again, some potential red flags there.
Mm-hmm. 48 next.
48, yes.
I have only a dumb sentence from that.
Is it the one about Midge's transition?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll save that one then, because nothing really happens in here. But she does have an uncanny habit of always being right. So you just, you know, you're establishing that. Like,
right.
Chapter 49. This is the chapter back in Spain on the punk bus. We read some of this in a real or fanfic segment that I believe tricked you. But he made up the reason they're all going to the club. It's because it's the anniversary of Judas Tabu's death. And we didn't really get to talk about that too much. I thought it was like trying to make up a name of a famous rock star is like when you see like a football uniform in a movie that couldn't get the actual rights to use football uniforms. And it's like, mm-hmm. This is the Sharks. And it's like, well, that looks fake as hell. And it sounds fake as hell.
It's so bad. And then to put it in the, to give it the context, he said, that, well, first of all, the punk spat in the aisle, obviously disgusted with Becker's ignorance. Judas Tabu, greatest punk since Sid Vicious. Ah?
Right.
So yeah, you're just not using the name of the world's most famous punk.
Right, yes. But, like, what is the rating system based on? Like, just his sort of aesthetic? Like, Sid Vicious was famous for, like, not even, like, knowing how to play the instrument. He was sort of, like, propped out there like a boy band member just to, like, you know, look the part. So... what is the rubric here?
I don't know. He's so obviously in over his head talking about this stuff. It's like Over the Top, the arm wrestling movie. Uh-huh. It's like the toughs who come in and mess with his son around the pinball machine. You know, guys with like cut off leather jackets. What are you doing in here, you nerd?
Right. Yeah. This
is what we're getting here in the form of these punks.
Yes, it's 100% Steve Buscemi, hello fellow punks type of thing.
Yes.
So the punks just, you know, sort of take delight in this square. Because he's like, where is this bus going? And this bus has like one stop or something. And the punk broke into a sudden wide grin. Oh, you mean you don't know? Becker shrugged. The kid started laughing hysterically. Oh, shit, you're going to love it. And that doesn't pay off either. It just is going to a rock club that's a couple miles outside the city.
You're going to be amazed by seeing you're already on a bus full of punks. We're going to a punk club. Yeah. Punks have been around now for how many years?
Oh,
what
sure.
What year was this book
this
written?
This is 98, so, I mean, you know, 75, you know, never mind the bollocks was probably 77. Like,
if you've been to any large city, and probably especially in Europe, you have seen, you know, punk culture
Mohawks,
by the thousands.
Studded jacket, sure.
But my God, are you going to be, you won't believe what you see. Is it a club full of punks and their punk music is being blasted out of speakers as they jump around?
Yeah.
Yes, that's pretty much it, exactly.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Are you volunteering at a hospice? We are. That's why it was going to be so surprising. It's punk day.
Now you spoiled the surprise. Thanks. Now I have to spit on the bus floor. Yeah.
Why was that your first guess? That's weird. So the punks is mostly funny based on Dan Brown's interpretation, but we cut back in chapter 50 to crypto. We get some I issued another settle the hell down because Chartrukian is sort of descending down into the innards of everything. Billows of steam swirled out of the opening, illuminated by the red utility lighting below. The distant hum of the generators became a rumble. Chartrukian stood up and peered into the opening. It looked more like the gateway to hell than a service entrance for a computer.
So did they add those features? Because right. They're clearly not necessary to sustain a computer system. So.
Yeah. It's like if you ever look on forums for people overclocking their rigs, they're always like, yeah, I added in the neon blue and the coolant system for this. It just makes it look cooler. And you see a computer that looks essentially like what he's describing here.
Right. A gaming computer. With the outside of it all jazzed up. Sure. All tricked out.
Right. So the NSA, that was Strathmore wanted that too. He wanted no cameras in here and he wanted it to look like a Alienware PC.
I want neon lights around it and flashing, and I want steam. That's my crusade. Hopefully it won't end in crucifixion. That is the official Strathmore voice, right?
Yeah, I think so. It always drops into that register. The thick flesh, I think, makes that. But
yes, exactly.
Crucifixion, sir? Well, yeah, I don't want them to look at the budget line items and sort of chew me out for going over on the steam generator.
And then promote me.
Yes.
That would be awful.
I don't have anything else. We can skip ahead to chapter 51.
Yeah, 50. I just had go to hell. 51, however.
This is indeed. An all-time great character introduction on the level of, Jar Jar Binks fleeing and running into Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon Jinn in the first Star Wars prequel.
Boy, you've nailed it. Exactly what I thought. We could just, all of Jabba, of course.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I wrote down was Jabba resembled a giant tadpole. Like the cinematic creature for whom he was nicknamed, the man was a hairless spheroid. It's like, I if you're picturing Midge, you at least have that Mad Men secretary vibe. This guy, I honestly don't know.
I don't know, but so he's talking to Midge, right?
Yes. On the phone, yes.
Jabba wiped his mouth. You on site? Yep. Care to join me for a calzone? Love to, Jabba, but I'm watching these hips. Really? Mind if I join you? You're bad. You have no idea.
Yeah, so Midge is able to swallow her bile and still like maintain the hair poofing, flirting with even this guy.
Yeah, putting the pencil into her bouffant and snapping her gum and just getting wise with Jabba.
Yeah, as he calls, Data Queen, the huge man gushed. He'd always had a soft spot for Midge. She was sharp, and she was also the only woman Jabba had ever met who flirted with him. So yeah, she might have a problem, actually. She might, she might have some sort of an addiction to the power that comes with flirting here. I don't know.
I would sleep with her, but she uses call waiting.
But you get this great moment. He's spared no dignity whatsoever. He's on his third pepperoni calzone. He's also drinking Dr. Pepper. So Dan Bound clearly didn't do his research and sub in Mountain Dew here, because that would be the beverage of choice. But I've got a report saying translator's been running the same file for 18 hours and hasn't cracked it. Jabba sprayed Dr. Pepper all over his calzone. So if you had given me that as as odds at the beginning of the book, I would not have put down a lot of money on that that happening.
And then shortly after, he dabbed at his calzone with a napkin. So just, again, thank you for the dignity, sir. And then later, Jabba furrowed his bulbous forehead.
That's a pair of words that have never been combined before, I don't think.
How do you? I was trying to picture that. His forehead is like bulbous. I don't know. It must be tough to furrow, I would think.
He could have the Robert Zadar like cherubism, maybe, if he's having weird bulbous parts, bulbous chin type of thing. And then after that, we get one that was I marked it as the gross sentence of the week. Jabba sucked in a long strand of mozzarella.
So. They should have made him the opposite, though, of the guy. Who's the guy? Oh, Brinkmore. Brinkmore is super Brinkhoffer. Yeah, super handsome dude who's a loser. Jabba should have just been like slaying the ladies and
right.
driving a supercar. And
right.
That would have been a nice twist on this. But no, he's just exactly what you exactly what you think he is, drawn in huge cartoon strokes.
Yeah, it's beyond the even what you would assume is a normal parody. He's you know, he probably has a rascal scooter or something that he has to transport himself around on. But despite all that, he still is just as horny as everybody else and subverting the conventions of 1998 office environment in terms of sexual harassment. Go get yourself laid or something. Midge sighed. I'm trying, Jabba. Believe me, I'm trying.
Jeez. Here's a question for you and the listeners. Jabba laughed.
Strathmore's been in there for 36 hours. Poor bastard. His wife probably said she can't come home. I hear she's bagging his ass.
Midge thought a moment. She'd heard that too. She wondered if maybe she was being paranoid. I've never heard the slang bagging his ass. What does that mean?
Well, there was a moment in the introduction of Strathmore that was like, he's been working so hard, and then the rumor was his wife was divorcing him.
Bagging his ass.
It's not common.
I've always heard bagging on him, but I just have never heard bagging his ass.
Yeah,
getting a divorce.
Yeah, kicking him to the curb or, you know, showing him the door. I don't know.
Huh. Well, Jabba, you got me there. I never heard that.
Speaking of slang, the same guy who tried to cast the line out and we did not bite on his fishing term, we were up on the deck of the same Nashville house. Do you remember this? And he had gone to the Caribbean, come back, and then he was hanging out in the dark on his Nashville roof and we turned on a light or something and he just yells from across the alley, "You guys spotlighting me?"
Yes.
Like, we're not gonna invite you over, man. Like, you know, spotlighting you? What? Like,
spot.
We turned on the Edison bulbs you have up here for the bachelorette parties.
Turns to the deck on the other side of him. These guys over here, spotlighting me.
We asked you to leave us alone. It's Susie's bachelorette, you creep.
It's just hard with all the spotlighting going on.
I brought rum back from, do you want to know where? No!
Super expensive. Oh, that guy was a legend.
We're probably going to get emails. He seemed nice, and you guys turned up your nose at him. Like, you knew.
You didn't see the for those criticizing us, he carried his own sort of sweaty desperation.
Yes, that's exactly how I'd describe it. The chapter 52 we can move to, but I think before we got to do some fan bit before we move on.
And now I bet they bitching because my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write about some fan fiction. Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction.
So this is the always popular real or fanfic segment where Mike is going to try to guess whether these next five passages are from later in Digital Fortress or from fanfic that our loyal listeners, many of them are Patreon supporters, have submitted. Patreon has been, I was trying to tell Lauren about what's been going on there, and it was like, man, yesterday we did a what if Andy Rooney was Principal Rooney in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, what that would sound like. We've done some character sketches with Bob Fingerman, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You've done some deep dives into some obscure genres of music that people seem to really enjoy. It's been a lot of fun, and you still get every episode early. All this other stuff is just isolation madness creeping in, I guess.
There's a ton of stuff on there. and it surely does span the gamut. Joke telling. We have 80s stand-up routines going way back.
Yeah, Bridget was doing improv the other day.
Yeah, we had improv things. We read jokes from Bennett Cerf's Atrocious Book of Puns. people, you're not on Patreon.
Well, I'm looking at it here. Hang on. So-and-so, 8 people have canceled their subscription since we started talking about hearing it out loud made them really question.
Yes. All right, so here we go.
Yep, we're going to have 5 of these. They could all be real, they could all be fanfic, or a combination of the two. Number one, Hulo Hot fingered the gun in his pocket, keeping it low. He would fire from hip level upward into Becker's spine. That way the bullet would hit either the spine or a lung before finding the heart. Even if the bullet missed the heart, Becker would die. A punctured lung was fatal. Maybe not in more medically advanced parts of the world, but in Spain it was fatal. 2 people, 1, and then Hulo Hot was there. Like a dancer performing a well-rehearsed move, he turned to his right. He laid his hand on the shoulder of the khaki blazer. aimed the gun, and fired. Two muffled spats.
Hulahot?
H-U-L-O-H-O-T.
H-U-L-O.
H-O-T.
Oh, okay.
It's not a name I've seen before, but... You think
it's like only. Belgian or something, and it's Yulo or something like that?
Yeah, you know, it's that could be Two-Tone's real name, too. You never know.
Boy. See, that's troubling. That's well done. But, I mean, Becker obviously doesn't get killed. I don't know. I'm going to say it's real.
Okay. Number two. Becker punched the accelerator on his accidentally purchased Vespa as the taxi behind him grew nearer. The bike didn't have a side mirror, but he didn't have to look to know the passenger was the man in the wire-rimmed glasses. "Can't this thing go any faster?" Megan shouted over the engine noise as David nearly ran into a cart full of oranges being pushed out into the plaza in the early morning hours. "What do you think?" David answered as he gave a sheepish look to the fruit merchant who was shouting at the Vespa. Becker was desperate. If he didn't do something quickly, the taxi would overtake them, and he and Megan would both be in the bespectacled assassin's sights. Sights? That was it. "Hang on," Becker yelled as he banked the Vespa hard to the right. He smiled and added, "We're going to visit Christopher Columbus."
Oh, boy. actual fruit cart is a good touch, but I'm going to say that that's fanfic.
All right. And the Christopher Columbus, we all know what...
callback. Yeah. Yeah.
Number three. Strathmore pounded his fist on the desk. "I should have known. His screen name, for Christ's sakes. Endacoda. Look at it." "What do you mean?" "He's laughing at us. It's a goddamn anagram." Susan puzzled a moment. "Endacoda is an anagram?" She pictured the letters and began reshuffling them in her mind. Endacoda, Kato Tan, Octadan, Tangdoka. Her knees went weak. Strathmore was right. It was plain as day. How could they have missed it? North Dakota wasn't a reference to the U.S. state at all. It was Tankado rubbing salt in the wound. He'd even sent the NSA a warning, a blatant clue that he himself was Endacoda. The letters spelled Tankado, but the best codebreakers in the world had missed it, just as he had planned.
I had to stifle during that whole thing.
Wow.
There's no possible way that's real. Delightful. But no, that's fanfic.
Okay. Number four. Becker's head pounded. He'd failed everyone, including his country. How could he go home and face Strathmore after this? Or Susan? A waiter wearing a polyester mockery of a nice suit approached the table, holding out a menu with bright pictures of tourist tapas. Because his eyes were too blurry to read a menu, Becker said, "Just bring me something authentic." As it warmed up, the street livened up for the day. Becker watched it in a sleep-deprived haze. At the last table on the pavement, a man in wire-rimmed glasses was ignoring the waiter behind him trying to take his order. His unnerving gaze was focused on Becker, as if trying to peer inside his skull. His hand hung limp at his side with his fingers twitching. Becker knew he should find a payphone. He checked his pockets for change. "Anguilas fritas con ajo y aceite," the waiter said with a flourish, placing a plate before Becker. On it rested toasted bread heaped with thin white worms with black eyes like poppy seeds. "Anguilas fritas con ajo y aceite," Becker echoed. "Fried eels with garlic and oil."
That sounds good. I'm going to go to, now from any restaurant I go to, I'm going to say, "Just bring me something authentic." This is our sure. Dorito Crunch Taco, sir. Yeah.
The triple lupa.
when you're actually working at a Spanish restaurant and somebody says, "Bring me something authentic," what is your reaction to that? I don't know what that means. This is just our food.
We had a really good time. Freshman year of college, went to visit friends at Columbia in New York, and went to Little Italy in New York. And my friend Justin, you know, made a big deal out of trying to find a authentic Italian place in Little Italy, which I'm not sure how he was judging it, like based on like which picture of Robert De Niro in their window, like was like, you know, the newest or something. They were all clearly tourist traps.
Yes. Well, I think that one is, I'm going to say it's real.
Okay. And number five, the final one. The Tokyo morning was crisp and bright. Tokugen Numataka strode furiously across the helipad, cell phone clasped in his fist. Betrayal. Something he'd thought that only the foolish and inexperienced would have to suffer. He'd woken to the offending email less than an hour ago. Pneumatech is mine unless you follow my demands. Await further instructions. Regards, N. Dakota. Pneumataka had to retreat from the city to think. The mountain air would clear his mind and guide him on how to strike back at this treacherous Kusatare. His subordinates could not hide their cringes, even as they bowed on either side of him. Numataka's fury was rarely seen, but when unleashed, it was a sight to behold.
Hmm. Well, that could be spot on, and therefore I smell a rat. I'm going to call that fanfic.
If that was just a chapter, though, that would, if I told you that, would that change? I mean, no.
I assume.
Yeah.
I assume all of them are just a chapter.
All right. Let's see how you did. I think you did much better.
Okay.
I think, yeah. Okay. Number one, that was the medically advanced part of the world, but in Spain it was fatal. You said that was real. That is real. Listener Kerry submitted that one.
Nice.
He thought that the slam on Spain might be the... right. Not sure what is... but I guess, yeah, it's fatal if the elderly woman peeing in the bedpan is taking up your room. Number right. two is the orange fruit cart. You said fanfic. That was fanfic submitted by Josh.
Nice.
Going to
nice.
Check on Christopher Columbus's scrotum.
Right.
might have been a bridge too far. Number three, that was Susan taking forever to realize that N. Dakota was an anagram. You said fanfic. That is real.
No way.
Submitted by
my
listener
God.
Jens. It's amazing. So that's the genius taking an absolute paragraph to
what the hell? Just making his characters dumber than a bag of oranges?
It's amazing. It's truly amazing. I don't know. And I don't know what part of the book. I didn't look up, you know, when we have that to look forward to. I don't know how long they draw out the thing further, so.
Oh my God.
As she's walking up, you'd think she'd be parsing that as she's preparing to tell him. But so we got that to look forward to.
I know someone who says that they look at Sudoku boxes and they can't do. They just fill them. Their mind fills them in.
Okay,
they're so good at numbers. And wouldn't you think that a code breaker kind of looks at the world that
right.
way? So that when they see. Mm-hmm. An anagram for the guy who's about to destroy the world that they might be just playing with it in their mind or something. But anyway, never mind.
Seven letter anagram is what it is. And so, yeah, that was the, when you play those word games, that's usually the amount of letters you get, like make the words out of these. And so, yep. Anyway, so that's, that is two out of three wrong so far. I'm sorry. That is two out of three correct so far. Next one is the eels. And these can be something authentic. You said real. That is fanfic submitted by Marie.
That's good.
Yep. So that's two out of four.
I hand it to you.
And then the final one was the one you said was too convincing, so therefore you smelled a rat. You said fanfic. That is fanfic submitted by Khan, the fury of Pneumataka.
Barely over 50%, baby. Uh-huh.
Three out Woo-hoo. Of five. So, yep. Well done, everybody. Send them in. You know, you see what works now. And, keep trying to do it. Do you want to do the next one? Let's have you read the next one. We got to do one of those per book.
Yeah, I'll do that. So, you putting in the fish, the fried eels, good hook for me. I bet.
And if people have submitted ones they think are convincing, like that one that they submitted of the idiot genius sussing out the anagram. Someone submitted that. So send those in too. Right. Let's get back to where we were. Which is chapter 52. Yep. So they're headed to Club Embrujo, which means warlock.
Why do they have to do that? Because everyone in this book, when they speak, they speak in their language and then they say it in English. So you should have just been on the sign. Club Embrujo, that means warlock, should have been on the sign of the club.
But. Yeah. Later, chapter 55, we get... he meets another punk and Becker just wearily thinks to himself, doesn't anyone speak Spanish in this damn country? So it's like, he's even sort of like throwing it out the window at this point in time.
Right.
We covered the notable part of this in a real or fanfic, the punks sort of messing with him, but someone is puking in the audience. I thought all that was missing was that old naked lady in her bedpan from the hospital.
I just had, the only thing I took from it was the dumb sentence, someone nearby started vomiting. So we don't get any idea whether they finished vomiting. They just started. But my chapter summary was, guy in the glasses gets a taxi. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what happens, right?
Yeah, and the taxi sort of gives him the, they only come out at night type of reaction. He goes, weirder crowd every night. It's like, is the guy with glasses that weird? Like, yeah. Is he wearing like a feather boa and carrying a ventriloquist puppet? Like, I don't know, you know.
Right. I think this was pulled out in the real or fanfic, but a teenage girl stared up at him looking like something out of Dawn of the Dead. Like, oh, Dan Brown, don't try to do these kind of, you know, sort of arch humor or something. Like, ugh, yeah. your examples are terrible.
Yeah, that's the end of that. Chapter 53 is, speaking of, Bob Kraft of the Patriots, the, Numa Numa guy himself is getting Orchids of Asia treatment, from a masseuse.
He's getting a massage to completion, as they say.
Yep, that's it. Yes. And that is the chapter.
Yep.
His subplot continues to be advanced, 180 words at a time.
She ground her palms into the fleshy pockets surrounding his shoulder blades.
Yes.
The fleshy pockets surrounding?
I don't know. Mine are not particularly fleshy.
Pockets are hollow, right? They're not. They're, you know, so surrounding. So the fleshy pockets.
Like you can work a finger down into a collarbone, maybe. I don't know, but that's not fleshy. That's obviously bony.
Yeah. Fleshy pockets. All right.
Thick fleshed, hopefully.
Oh, and sweaty as hell. all right.
Chapter 55.
That's like two. Yeah. Here we go.
This is, he meets the punk named Two Tone, who is just, the punks in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies were more well thought out than this guy. He's got a two tone of hair color. He's got a safety pin in his nose. And it just is pretty stupid.
Yes. Yeah.
You're
on chapter 55.
I'm sorry, we skipped chapter 54.
54. There's not much, but I did have a sonic challenge for you.
Oh boy.
You ready?
Okay.
You have to memorize some lines.
Okay. I think I see what it's going to be, but
yeah, you got it. This is let's see. Chartreukian
is
arguing with someone off screen.
Mm-hmm.
You don't believe me? The sound of more arguing rose. We have a virus. Then the sound of harsh yelling. We need to call Jabba. Then there were sounds of a struggle. Let me go. So I'll read
all
the line.
Three of those? Okay, yeah.
I'll read the line and you do the sounds in between.
Okay.
Do you have it there in front
of
you?
Yeah, I had that pulled out because it was such crappy writing.
Okay, so I'll be Chartreukian and you be the sounds. Okay. You don't believe me?
That's argue.
We have a virus. We need to call Jabba. Let me go. All right, well done.
So yeah, that was rising arguing, harsh yelling, and the sounds of a struggle.
Yes.
Okay. Well, two can play at this game. The Chartreukian then falls to his death off of like a 160-foot ladder. The noise that followed was barely human. It was a long wailing cry of horror, like a tortured animal about to die, that ended abruptly as it has begun. Then there was a silence. So just in case you thought that there would be noise after the noise ended, there was a silence.
That's my challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Noise that followed barely human, but
long
human.
Wailing cry of horror, like a tortured animal about to die that ended abruptly as it had begun.
Okay. There's going to be a little noise as I have to kind of slide my microphone away from me.
Don't want
to
blow it out.
Because otherwise I'll blow this thing out. All right. So yeah. All right.
I thought that was a tortured capybara. Is that the animal that was you were going for? Okay. Fainting goat, maybe?
Well, one of my favorite animals, by the way. I almost talked one of our our coworkers into, because he has a pool and you need a pool, almost talked him into buying a capybara.
I remember that.
He didn't. He's married, so obviously didn't pan out. But it would have been my greatest thing.
Yeah, he would have been probably a Tiger King documentary by this point in time.
Yeah, yes.
I remember that. That was like, you know, around the shuffleboard table or something on a Friday afternoon. And like, I was like, got to get something done. I walked out the capybara talk, and it was like sort of hard to get into the bit, you know, because I hadn't been there in the first place. And I came back like an hour later, and it was still capybara talk. And I was like, my God, can we please move on from
That's what we do at Riff Tracks, people.
And all right. Yeah, chapter 55. Let's get to Two-Tone.
Two-Tone. Here we go.
So, as we just saw, the dialogue here is just, you know, grade Z. With the yelling and stuff. But then when you have to do the dialogue of what a teenage punk or like 20-year-old punk would be saying, it really gets down, you know, downgraded below grade Z. So you have Two-Tone and David Becker calling each other runny-nosed little runt, a walking billboard for birth control.
Oh, God, and then, that is the worst.
And then just your traditional Beavis and Butthead ass wipe. But like, you know, I like Stephen King, but sometimes he will launch into you know, the type of like vernacular where it just sort of sounds like nails on a chalkboard, like, and that's what this sort of reminded me of.
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock.
Yeah, that type of thing.
Oh my God. But here's before we get to that, the reiteration of this crap of him, Becker's patience ran out. Wasn't he supposed to be in the Smokies with Susan? What was he doing in Spain, arguing with a psychotic adolescent? Like, yes, that's what's happening.
Right.
Why are you reiterating it?
Right.
How stupid do you think we are? This happened like a paragraph ago. You know, like it's why does he continue to have to point back to his own plot?
Yeah, unless it's one of those, you know, previously on Breaking Bad segments that would start because it had been a week and you'd forgotten. I don't know what to do, especially because it's not like him thinking about questioning his actual actions. He's like, why haven't I called for help yet? That would be a good question to sit and sort of toss over in your head for a few minutes.
Yeah. Or you know, the man in wire-rimmed glasses said to himself, boy, it sure is hot here in Spain where I am looking for a guy to assassinate. That's the kind of stuff that he's doing. He's not thinking that.
Right.
Wasn't he supposed to be in the Smokies with Susan? Very strange sentence construction anyway.
Yeah, you might as well have him just be like, you know, David decided that he needed to put his left foot in front of his right and then alternate making himself, you know, ambulatory towards the bathroom.
We do get I was surprised to hear this little detail. Becker corrected him as he flagged a passing waitress. He bought two... Aguila? Is that the beer?
Yeah, I don't. I'm not familiar, but
Aguila beers, and handed one to Two-Tone. The boy looked shocked. He took a swig of beer and eyed Becker warily. I gotta hand it to the punk clubs. Great service. He flagged a passing waitress, so everyone's jumping around and hitting each other with pool cues and pulling out each other's safety pins and punching each other in the face and shaking the blood on each other as the music is going crazy, and he's like, he holds up a finger. Ma'am, would it be all right if I had two of your finest flagons of ale? Why, of course, sir. Here you are. Oh, you have them right on you, do you? Jolly good.
Right. You go to the Bellagio and are sitting at a gaming table or something, and you ask for two aguilas, and it takes 5 or 10 minutes for them to make the rounds because they're not walking around with every drink possible to serve you. Like.
Oh, well, that's just a fact I didn't know. You know, you can bag on the Spanish healthcare system all you want, but their their liquor delivery systems are top-notch.
This was good, too, because, as we said, the dialogue is revolting, and nothing is about it is amusing at all. But, like, the other punks are just loving it. Again, witty dialogue. This is all unedited. Two-Tone, let me guess, because of your hair, no shit, Sherlock. Catchy name. You make that up yourself? Damn straight, he said proudly. I'm going to patent it. Becker scowled. You mean trademark it? The kid looked confused. You need a trademark for a name, Becker said. Not a patent. Whatever, the punk screamed in frustration, which I marked as an honest reaction.
Yeah.
The motley assortment of drunken and drugged out kids at the nearby tables were now in hysterics. So they're like pounding the table and like wetting their pants because they've come to this punk club, gotten hammered, and they're now watching a middle-aged guy fight with Two Tone, and they think it is absolutely hilarious right. that he got served on trademark versus patent definitions.
Yep, he got Shrek bearded by a Erm guy, and they just love it.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get enough.
And also, you know, Two Tone's been buying beers, but David offers him some money for some intel, and he asks for $100. And David Becker says, "I only have pesetas." And then Two Tone says, "Make it 100 pesetas." And then Becker like sort of irms him and realizes that's only 87 cents. But, you know, Two Tone has been buying beers. He must have some sort of idea about the value of the local currency.
But he takes the deal, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. So he's going to walk like back into the bar and, yeah.
I'll give you $100. No way. Well, I'll give you 100 pennies. You got a deal. He knows the value of the both, right?
Yes, yes. He had many bottles of beer he had purchased, so he's going to walk back in, and that will only occur to him once he's reaching for his wallet.
Once again, we have people being, different levels of intelligence from one nanosecond to the next.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's able to get around and feed himself, but somehow does not know doesn't know the value of things.
Yeah.
That's all I have for that one.
Yeah, chapter 56 is pretty short, too. It's Midge realizing that I guess the lights go out in Crypto.
Yes, that's what happened when the what's his name's body fell or whatever, right?
Yes. Chartrukian's body calls back that the definition of the original computer bug. He was the moth that landed on a system and shorted things out.
Yep, yep. This is one of my takeaways. I only have two for this. In addition to the 32-foot mahogany table with the NSA seal inlaid black cherry and walnut, the conference room contained 3 Marion Pike watercolors, a Boston fern, a marble wet bar, and, of course... the requisite Sparklets water cooler. Why in the name of God is that an of course?
A particular brand name of water cooler in the office. You know, water coolers known to be the hub where an office gathers.
But they're describing this obviously very ornate and well-appointed thing, and then... a Sparklets water cooler. Of course, you idiot. I've never heard of that. I don't know if it's a real brand name or not, but it doesn't matter. Like, what does that mean?
It is, because they had trucks in San Diego that would drive around, and they had this, like, glittery tile on the outside that was very distracting when you were driving. Like, their trucks had this almost like a mobile on it, so it would move and catch the light.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds good. But,
yeah, right. They must have been delivering to those government offices.
Midge had always felt comforted by the sight of the Crypto Dome, a glowing beacon regardless of the hour. She had? Really? Comforted? So she's sashaying around the office, snapping the gum, throwing sexual innuendos out like free candy to everyone. But then looking over at the glowing Crypto Dome and going, I'm comforted. Just another Dan Brown idiot thing.
Yeah.
Unnecessary. Unforced error.
I've got a Walgreens I can see from out my window. I just find their white logo comforting on the item side.
Yep. It's like eating some of your grandma's stew or something. It just brings you back.
Green light on the end of Daisy's dock. Like,
yeah.
This is another Dan Brown thing that I just, means nothing and is not worth dwelling on. But so she's like looking, I guess, at this comforting sign. And like, I guess that's the better view from this office. And Midge had once suggested that Director Fontaine move his office, but the director had simply replied, "Not on the rear. Fontaine was not a man to be found on the back end of anything."
Yeah,
I just wrote eight question marks. My friend, it's not worth dwelling on, but my friend had an idiot roommate freshman year that he just like had all sorts of dumb sayings, and you know, he would never drink. He would drink a drink that had one type of fruit in it, but not more than one, because that meant it was fruity. And that sounds what the director of the NSA is using, the same kind of logic here.
Not on the rear. Yeah, so she had suggested that, but there's no follow-up of, sir, what does that mean?
Like, I'm worried about the director. He seems very diminished very quickly.
I'm worried that his wife is bagging his ass. Because we're talking about rears right now, and he's not into them, I guess.
Right.
All right. 57?
We've got one more chapter with a lot of weight to it, but 57 is not that chapter. This is Susan in the power outage. As we said before, when she sent a, felt like some sort of growing fear, this is very similar to that. She stood dead still for a moment, trying to get her bearings, acutely aware of the growing sense of panic gripping her body. She's been terrified and on edge the entire time we've been discussing today. The horrible cry.
I did point out that was Klein adjacent.
Okay.
She was aware.
Okay, nice.
Acutely aware of a growing sense of panic.
She checks her, iWatch and is like, oh, yeah, I was correct. Heartbeat has increased.
Yep.
The horrible cry that you imitated from the ventilation shaft seemed to hang all around her. Despite her effort to fight off a rising sense of dread, fear swept across her flesh and took control. So, I mean, again, she's been at 11 in terms of dread and fear and panic, and it still somehow is continuing to rise and grow.
Here's a little game for you in this, and then we'll quickly move on. We're getting there, people. Yep. The most chilling image of all was not of Chartreukian, but of someone else, another body, halfway down the long staircase, crouched, hiding in the shadows. The muscular frame was unmistakable. It was Greg Hale. So there's three figures here. Let's run them down by levels of chillingness.
Okay.
We have Chartreukian, we have Greg Hale, and we have the director. And so she's chilled by them all. The most chilling image was not of Chartreukian, which was chilling.
Okay.
And then so which do you, would you, so Greg Hale's the most chilling. So is Chartreukian or the director the second
most chilling? Oh, I guess it's got to be the dead guy. I mean.
Yeah. Oh, wrong.
What?
Nice try.
Nope. What?
Nope, the second most chilling.
Damn. Second most chilling was the streaks of mozzarella grease Jabba had left on the door of the clubhouse.
All right, chapter 58.
58 is the last one that I have substantial notes on. This is back to the punk club. And he's asking Two-Tone about the ring. I mean, and this sort of gets into more just like, in what world is this a realistic situation? Two-Tone wanted to buy it, I guess, off of this woman, who is the girlfriend of one of his punk buddies. And he says she wanted more than the 50 I offered. She was trying to buy a plane ticket standby. She's long gone by now. Went to the airport hours ago. That's the best spot to hawk the ring. Rich tourists and shit. Once she got the cash, she was flying out. So let's parse this. She has an object she wants to sell. And where does she think she's going to get the best offer for this? By going to the airport, the place that I am frequently buying objects off of strangers that they're trying to unload in a panic.
I that was my note. Does this check out? I don't think that people, the best place, rich tourists, but the tourists come to, eat fried eels in the plazas and piazzas and whatever.
Yeah. Like,
they're everywhere. What do you...
If
you were just trying to get out of the airport, you're not doing business there.
Yeah. If you were ever approached by a guy in an airport, at the Chili's to go, who was trying to sell you a Rolex or something, you would just be like, get the hell away from me, security.
Yes, that's another thing I don't like about Spain. Your stifling heat, your terrible medical system, and the inability to control you hawkers of bad jewelry at the airport. Your service, drink service is great. I'm not bagging your ass on that at all.
Oh. But then it gets even more crazy. because what's his name? Becker asked, what flight was she taking? She said something about the Roach Coach. Did she say something about the Roach Coach, or did she say, I'm taking the Roach Coach? Because when she has said the Roach Coach, that sort of leads you to believe that might be the... But Becker says, Roach Coach? Yeah, weekend red-eye, Seville, Madrid, LaGuardia. That's what they call it. College kids take it because it's cheap. Guess they sit in back and smoke roaches. So has he ever been met a punk, smoked weed, or flown on an airplane? Because, like, in... Like, I don't think the smoking sections on planes even existed in 98, let alone weed smoking sections, which you'd be stopped immediately.
It's also, what is going on with using that term? Like, if I said to you, hey, I'm headed out to the Roach Coach, can I get you a sandwich?
Right.
You would say, you're flying and sitting in the back with a bunch of punks and you're going to smoke roaches? Like, no, we all know what Roach Coach means, right? That's a phrase that has been around for many years.
Okay, yeah, it was before food trucks were fancy, before they were. Yes. That was what you would say for the, taco truck that would show up outside of San Diego offices.
It has never been applied to an airplane flight that shuttles punks back and forth.
But then this is where it truly went off the rails for me. Becker checked his watch. It read 1:45 a.m. He turned to Two-Tone, confused. You said it's a 2 a.m. flight? The punk nodded, laughing. Looks like you're fucked, old man. Becker pointed angrily to his watch. But it's only 1:45. It boggled the mind. He looked at a flight that departs at 2, saw that there was 15 minutes until that happened, and thought, I have time to intervene in this situation. Yes. Right? I mean, this is what, that's what the only, I didn't understand.
I wouldn't be optimistic in that situation.
Let's say I was dropping you off at the airport with 15 minutes to go to get the flight. You would not be optimistic in that situation, even though it's pre 9/11, it's still, So I had questions about that. I went to the dark web trying to see if there was any sort of explanation for diagrams, like what it takes to get to the Seville airport. Maybe it's smaller. Maybe it was, pre 9/11, there was less security. Didn't find any of that stuff, but did find other incidences of this David Becker character just not having a good grasp on time as a...
Oh, so the dark web... noticed the same thing that you did, and so put up other instances?
Yes, of him having
issues with time.
Yeah, of sort of like not understanding what it was going to take to accomplish something and sure. sort of wildly overstating it. So they leaked those reenactments. You can listen to them now if we want to.
Oh, well, you downloaded.
Downloaded them, yeah. I mean, that was sort of implied. We rarely just discuss the things on the dark web. We usually point them out and share them with the audience.
No, let me search in my memory. You know what? I think that checks out. That is true. We've mostly played them.
We never established it as a, policy firmly, but that's sort of just been our unspoken understanding.
It's true. It's kind of like real or fanfic where, someone, I guess, could read all. All right. Let's listen to this.
Okay. Wait, you said the flight leaves at?
2 a.m.
It's 1:45. That means... there's still a chance. Give me that Vespa. All right, now to just... Oh, and the jetway door's closed.
David, you gonna be ready for the Shakespeare exam tomorrow? You haven't been to class all semester.
Of course I'll be ready. I just have to... cram like I've never crammed before. I'll pull an all-nighter. All I have to do is read the entire first folio. One play every 12 minutes and... I'm gonna fail.
Yo, David, Super Bowl kicks off in 3 minutes. Where's the wings?
Heat at 450 for 35 minutes. Serve with choice of dipping sauce. There's still a chance. Just gotta preheat the oven and I'll be able to...
Never mind. Bears just ran it back for a touchdown. Hey, David, who, for the purposes of this specific bit, is a grasshopper? Aren't you gonna put away any food for winter?
It's December 20th, you dumb ant. I've still got plenty of time to fiddle. You ants have fun working your butts off.
Don't let him near the queen. Hey, Dad, got time to teach me how to throw a ball? I'm going to grow up soon and resent you for being absent.
Nah, planes to catch, bills to pay, but I'll tell you this. We'll get together then, and I know we'll have a good time then.
Looks like you blew it again. Hand over the car keys, old man.
Hello, David. I'm acclaimed director Christopher Nolan. I'd like to direct a film about your life.
Oh my God, Christopher Nolan! From Memento to Interstellar to Dunkirk, your films mess with the audience's expectation about time in ways no other director has explored. Finally, the unique way I perceive time will be justified and...
Nah, not doing the time-bending thing anymore.
You're what?
Yeah, was feeling boxed in. Didn't want to become a self-parody. Now I'm directing a movie about a dumbass who drinks a lot of juice.
Damn it.
Humiliating water fountain scene, take one.
So yeah, he seemed to have all sorts of issues, really, and it went some interesting directions. He was a grasshopper and that sort of Aesop's fable, and met Christopher Nolan. So I mean, it's
wow. Thank you, Dark Web.
Yeah, they did some great job.
They do good stuff.
So this is even the plot thickens more because listener Taylor wrote in and said he has noticed some more misprints in my copy of the book. And this is the dodecahedron syndrome from Armada. In his copy of the book, which is a blue cover with a green text, it said 1:45 p.m.
Hmm.
And he's getting to the airport, which would imply then he has, you know, over 12 hours to get there. But that's absurd because it's the punk club and people are hammered in the middle of the night. So maybe they realize that this didn't check out time-wise, but they just wanted to change the A to a P type of thing instead of changing the actual timing. I don't know.
That just doesn't seem that hard.
It's so stupid.
To make that.
It's I don't know.
To make that time work out.
So, the clock is ticking. He has 15 minutes. He runs. He asks the bouncer to hire him a taxi. That's not going to happen. Doesn't take enough time. And then a couple pulls up on a Vespa and he gives them a 10,000 peseta note. They say, grazie. And then he tossed Becker the keys to the Vespa. Then he grabbed his girlfriend's hand and they ran off laughing into the building. Aspetta, Becker yelled. Wait, I wanted a ride. And that's how the chapter ends.
Chapter ends with a key flip exchange cliche from what? Probably done. I mean, it had to be done in the 40s, probably, but, you know, I think more of like a wacky 60s movie. Like, yep. I got to get her at the gate.
You can't park here.
You can't park here.
Keep
it's
it.
Yours. Keep it. Yep. Roadhouse opens with one.
right.
You recall.
To a homeless guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I feel like there might be one in Over the Top, too. Like him, the kid drives to the airport or something.
Oh, wow.
The son?
There's one in... is it Crossroads? Does Crossroads have one?
It very well might. I think it does.
We've done at least 5 or 6 movies with key flip exchanges.
It's good for
Dan
drama.
Dan Brown was ahead of the curve on that.
Yep. And then, we move on to chapter 59, where we get another one of your favorite things. Commander Greg Hale is North Dakota. There was a seemingly endless beat of silence in the dark. Finally, Strathmore replied. Commander, are you big news? We should probably act on this information because he is in the clubhouse. So
I will go steep a bag of tea and I'll be back.
Yes,
and when you're ready to respond to that,
I know your ass has been getting bagged, but that's no excuse for not leaping into action.
Here's good solid prose here. Good action prose. Susan went on to explain how Hale had stopped her tracer. I love when someone in a novel went on to explain. You don't say. Wow, I wish we could hear what she's explaining. That sounds thrilling.
Right, yes. Information we already know.
Yes.
And they end up that chapter by locking the hatch, which is like a submarine hatch, into the bottom of the translator's inner workings, thinking that Hale is still crouched in down there as his most alarming self. But neither Strathmore nor Susan heard the faint steps in the direction of Node 3. So I guess he's gotten out of there as she was explaining it to him, or as he was pausing in silence for an extended period of time.
I wondered if the faint footsteps is. I don't know how time works in this book. Could it be two-tone? You think that's who it is?
Right. Yeah. Maybe they have employed their own version of Nolan time.
That's all I have for that one.
Yeah. And then chapter 60 is the final one of this section, which I just have a note about the plot. So if you've got any of the actual writing.
I do have the two-tone felt a hand brush over his wallet.
Okay.
I mean, I guess. Your wallet doesn't really, you know, have a sensation to it, but I guess you can feel that. It's just a strange...
Yeah, it's
strange
good
wording.
Good that he does have a wallet, though, because he's, you know, he's like living in the gutter and hammered and stuff. But does he have a like George Costanza wallet? Are there like, does he have like Sandwich Club cards in the wallet? Like, is he, he's got his platinum card.
He pulled out 1,000 pesetas and went, oh, God, I forget. How much is this again? Damn it.
But then, it ends up with the wire rim glasses breaking his neck. So he's just, you know. Clearing up all these loose ends piece by piece for what I don't know why he needed his neck broken, but it's just sort of the kiss of death that David Becker's in passing on to everyone he meets.
Man, two-tone, we hardly knew you.
Oh, wow. Well, that's it for the meat of the book, but we still have some dumb sentences we can read to people.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is
So these are going to be the dumb sentences of the week submitted by our listeners. Lots to choose from this time, so let's get right to it. First of all was Janelle, who submitted, Jabba resembled a giant tadpole. I'm thinking, you know, like Stinky the Hutt. That's what I've got there.
Stinky the Hutt has been kidnapped? Wasn't that a line from the trailer?
I think so. no, I don't think it was. I think Stinky, I don't know. It was definitely a something we focused on. But I don't know if they ever called him Stinky the Hutt. I think she called him Stinky. His name was Rota the Huttlet.
Yes.
Who was born from Jabba's brood pouch. Because Hutts reproduce asexually.
Oh, God.
That is information from 12 years ago that I somehow still remember.
Well, so does Jabba.
He's, I guess so. That's why pouch. He had the nickname. Is he just has a bunch of pepperoni pizza combos in his brood pouch.
On his bulbous forehead, maybe? Isn't there an animal that keeps the young on the head?
Is that a seahorse thing, maybe?
Anyway, we're getting in the weeds.
We are. Right. Andrew, this is from Brinkerhoff. Midge, I have no life. So his flirting, he says, from bad flirting to drunken depression talk. Michael pointed out your same thing about the bus downshifting.
Oh, good.
So
all
that
right.
wasn't
That's
just,
not just me.
Pedantry. George pointed out the sticky, sweet chime of his mantle clock accented the end of another day of his pathetic existence. So that is also Brinkerhoff. I mean, once you've got a mantle and a clock on the mantle, you're doing all right for yourself.
He seems like he's killing it. I just don't get it.
Yeah. This is Heather. This is regarding David and two-tone. David is thinking, I want you to wash your hair, clean up your language, and get a job. It's like,
God.
Don't make the hero sound lamer than the idiots he's interacting. This was Christina submitted the same one about the wasteland of public email and cyber porn. Michael submitted a dwarf-like bartender lay a napkin in front of him. That was, you know. The first one of the whole section, and it's still hard to top for dumbness. Harris submitted as he began plowing through. This is Brinkerhoff as he began plowing through the document and checking the daily MCDs. Images of Carmen Huerta smearing herself with honey and confectioner's sugar began playing in his head. 30 seconds later, he was almost done, and Harris just said, "Almost done doing what?" Jim submitted, unfortunately, like so many divine quests, this one ended, crusade ended in crucifixion. We had a lot of fun with that. Tom submitted Jabba sprayed Dr. Pepper all over his calzone. Ben submitted, he cursed the bartender and his jet lag. That's the dwarf-like bartender. And he said, sure. Look, I'm far from an English major, but the way Dan Brown wrote this, it implies that the bartender is the one with the jet lag. And Becker is cursing it. Just add a comma and make the sentence just another boring sentence. Yeah, that's the Oxford comma, lack thereof, hurting your point. Curtis submitted, of course, the officers of the NSA realized that stored data had value only if it was accessible. And he said, that's not really something someone has to realize, but at least they didn't feel themselves realizing it.
Yes. Began to feel themselves realizing.
Sherry had Midge helped herself to a glass of water, hoping it might calm her nerves. And Sherry said, in this time of stress and uncertainty, I've been downing water like it was water because of its anxiety reducing properties. And Taylor submitted, his hair was thick, sandy blonde, and most importantly, all his own. He said, this sounds less like Brinkerhoff's hair is natural and more like he's no longer making payments on it. That is it. What do you have?
We promised it, so I'll deliver it. Ever since Skipjack, whenever Midge had a sense that something suspicious was going on, she made an eerie transition from flirt to fiend. Why was it eerie?
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
So someone watching her get a suspicion was like, oh, man. Oh, I feel like something dead just walked past
yeah.
me. Oh.
A cloud passes God. In front of the full moon and there's a distant howl.
Yes.
Yeah. That was submitted by Khan as well. I did not read it because I knew you had it coming. I had a good one, too. This is as Becker is trying to, he's leaving the hotel, still tipsy, but he starts chasing the bus. And it says, his usual squash agility was not with him, though. And I just thought that usual squash agility was a tremendously dumb phrase to have to impart upon us.
I had written that note about him feeling drunk over, you know, half a vodka cranberry. And he's like cursing the bartender, damn it, adding that vodka in there. And then I made a note about like the world's best squash player is just like felled by a lady drink. And then two sentences later. But his squash agility.
Right.
Like, really? We're actually picking that thread up?
All right. Well, let's conclude the episode. We didn't have time for it last time, but we do today. Some emails from our listeners.
We ain't going to the party. We ain't going to the game. We ain't going to the disco. Ain't going to cruise out, man.
So we first have a couple of episodes about Dan Brown's masterclass. This first one comes from Mike. He says, a brief masterclass update. I think Mike is the guy who's been watching the Dan Brown masterclass.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Brown informs us there is no greater task than editing. He said it with a straight face. Brown also appears to value page turning more than anything else. I think that's very clear. He says, as long as you turn that page, he's doing his job. He does admit there's a fine line between building suspense and annoying the hell out of the reader.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well.
He also grabbed a screenshot during one of the lessons. What a bucket has to do with reminding. So the screenshot says, it looks like it says number 11, remind the reader of the stakes. And then there's a picture of a bucket. He says, I grabbed a screenshot during one of the lessons. What a bucket has to do with reminding the reader of the stakes eluded me, but my fellow jackals drew an immediate link to Blariana. I'm pleased about that every time there's
a...
Yeah,
give a little golf clap for that one. That's good.
John also is... I think he was watching just... He got an ad for the masterclass, and he's posted it to the Facebook group page, but wanted to share it here too. I found an amazing quote from Dan Brown where he likens his writing process to Aerosmith's process, red flag already, of daring to suck. He even mentions it in the YouTube ad for his masterclass. And he says, as you can see below, I think he forgot the part of the process where you improve on your suckiness. So he has this clip.
Wow.
I'm not sure how we got this clip, but maybe it's an interview or maybe he watched the masterclass. But it says, this is Dan Brown. Strangely, I learned a lot about creativity from someone who was very different than I. A man named Steven Tyler, who happens to be the lead singer of Aerosmith. Which is a very strange way to put that.
Who happens to be?
Yeah, Steven Tyler just wakes up one day and they assign him that title. It's like metamorphosis, except he's not a giant bug. Well, he kind of is. I had the experience of sitting next to him and talking about the creative process, and he told me, so he pretty much says Aerosmith has this process of daring to suck, where they come to a meeting with an idea that is just half formed and there's no judgment. They just say like, I know this is probably going to suck, but he says 9 out of 10 times it's terrible. But the other one out of those times you get dude looks like a lady or love in an elevator. So,
Wow. Okay. And that's supposed to,
that's the high watermark.
Okay. did I ever tell you my son's experience with with Steven Tyler. He was in Nashville, and he came out of a, I think, a rather plain grocery store. Nothing, no, not a place you would expect to see Steven Tyler. And it was like 10 a.m. or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven Tyler was Steven Tyler. Like, he was done up. He wasn't, you know, hiding behind sunglasses and wearing a khaki jacket or something.
He looked like Jack Sparrow or...
Yeah, there was boas and everything. And my son just, like, because he almost ran into him, was like, "Hey, wow, Steven Tyler, how's it going?" And Steven Tyler, like, did, like, a spin move and pointed double guns at him or something and went, "Woo!" Or something like that. He, like, gave him the Steven Tyler experience.
Wow, not bad.
And then hopped into his car, and my son was pleased, put a little spring in his step for the whole day.
Yeah, Steven Tyler made someone's day. Well, that was probably the day that Steven Tyler realized that he happened to be the lead singer of Aerosmith, so he was probably in a good mood.
Oh, my God. I just realized. This is great. I'm going to stop buying ham buns, and I'm going to go spin around in the parking lot.
This next email comes from Andy. He says, "I held back during the first week, but after a few more assignments, I feel pretty confident that Dan Brown invented Tenkato as a Japanese surname. In all my time studying Japan and living there, I've never heard a surname like this. What's more... in the Japanese localization of Digital Fortress called Puzzle Palace," so we have another reader reading this in sort of a different language, yeah. "Ensai Tenkato is written using characters reserved for non-Japanese words."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a weird little detail. "My only conclusion was that Dan Brown invented Tenkato as a vaguely Japanese-sounding name to fit his N-Dakota code name working backwards. I haven't read ahead, but this alone makes me think there is some major spoiler related to this. I hope there's something more clever here, but my conclusion does not inspire hope." So, yeah, that's interesting about the characters reserved for non-Japanese words.
I would just say that the first time I saw the name, I don't know much about Japanese language, obviously. I don't. For half a year, I had a Japanese girlfriend who was trying to teach me a little bit. But when I saw the name, I was like, that does not strike me as a Japanese name. But.
Okay.
I guess that's confirmed.
Yeah. it'd be interesting to see what that looks like compared to actual Japanese characters, or maybe it just is a different subset of them that we wouldn't recognize. But good details. That and bouncy or whatever. Saucy meant juicy.
Saucy.
In Danish. This one is from Yanni. He said, "I was trying desperately to distract myself from thinking about the most ignominious death a character had ever suffered in any of the 372 pages books we've read." I think this was based on Chartreukian plummeting into the guts of the computer and shorting it out like a moth. And he said, I think that what led the way for him, but he said, "And this is taking into account that we've read about people being stabbed with rat bones." That was an Eye of Argon. "And having whips made out of their own internal organs, as happened in Shadow Moon."
Yeah. Oh, Shadow Moon, that shall not be named.
So yeah, I don't know what I would think. I mean, there were some pretty bad ones in White Worm as well, I feel like.
What about our hooker underneath 4,000 pounds of German? I guess
that might have been what he was thinking about. So yeah, poor whatever her name was. Well, and then Blariana died as a sex slave next to her own poo bucket. So.
Wow, you elicited a laugh out of me for that. Thanks a lot. Thanks so much.
So, yeah,
I look like a monster.
A good topic of debate. And then finally, email. This is from Blake, who, unbeknownst to us, this is like that guy, Andrew, who wanted to finish reading the Shadow Moon series. He did not have to. Blake picked up Ron Goulart's Great History of Comics.
What?
And was reading, he says, among the Tumble Twos, of course, and Ogdens. He says there were many in the early days of comics, apparently. I don't know if either of those are jokes. On page 305, Goulart talks about the mutant office at Marvel, which was responsible for turning the X-Men into a big deal. This actual sentence appears. Editor Jim Shooter, that's a cool name, had set up, with the help of writer Chris Claremont and editor Ann Nocenti, what was known around Marvel as the mutant office. So the worlds collide again, and he says, Blake says, as I've said on the Discord, the valley of the 372 pages is bounded by the Bader-Meinhof River on one side and the Dunning-Kruger on the other.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
It's yes.
A tangled web we weave.
The streams are crossing.
So, yeah, and I'm not sure if I would read Ron Goulart anything else he wrote, but I'm glad other people do it for us.
That's amazing. Yeah. Who knew that we lived in like a... We've been doing rich world building just by reading bad books.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I guess it's like any sort of industry. You get to know people and you do each other favors, and it's like the, you know, the podcast world. Everyone shows up on each other's podcast.
Well, not so much ours, but I've heard that to be a thing.
Well, that's it, I think. We'll put a next week's assignment in the show notes and kind of take it from there.
I'm sad to see a two-tone go, but there'll be other characters who will show up and be just as lame and will be killed instantly by Glasses Guy. So
I believe so.
There's a lot to look forward to.
Yeah, we have a 15-minute journey to the airport to see how that plays out. So thanks, everybody.
So long, everyone. This is 372 pages. We'll never get back.